The podcast under the stairs. Void diary entry number 22.
Hello? I don't know if anyone's getting this message at all, but this is Duncan from the podcast under the stairs. I encoded a message at the start of the previous episode, one that explained what my current situation is. Things are getting incredibly weird around here, weirder than they usually are. I get the feeling that someone's constantly watching me, and I'm not entirely sure if my message made it out on the previous show. I'm getting asked to do things at the moment which I don't agree with, you know, work on audio samples to embed in future shows to send out. I think that they may be viruses used to corrupt people from my time. I don't really know what to do at the moment, but what I've managed to do is keep them at bay with promises for future shows and future releases. I need to find a way to get out of here. I need to find a way to get back. End of message.
You're listening to Druid FM on 192 BC.
Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone, and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs, episode number 61. I'm your host Duncan McLeish, and welcome to the show. Episode 61 is number 9 on my top 10 countdown of the best horror performances by Christopher Lee and Vincent Price. They're going head to head each week for the 10 weeks that we're doing the top 10, and what we'll be doing is myself and my guest at the end of each show will be deciding who had the better performance and who will win the points. Last week, if you've been listening, my good friend Gary Hill was on and we looked at Horror Express and The Raven, and Vincent Price won the first 2 points of the contest. So we can only wait till the end of this episode to find out if Christopher Lee can pull it back to an even draw, or if Vincent Price will extend his lead. My guest for this episode is Mike Merriman from Evil Episodes and the Not So Evil Sidecast. He will be joining me to discuss the Vincent Price movie, The Fall of the House of Usher, or if you were in America, just The House of Usher. And for the Christopher Lee movie, we'll be doing Dr. Terror's House of Horror. Both fantastically fun movies that I can't wait to discuss coming up later on the show. But what I'd like to do just at the start here is thank everyone for their participation over on the Facebook page. You guys are pretty fucking awesome. I know I say it all the time, and maybe you think that I'm being disingenuous when I say it, but I really mean that. You guys make this show very easy to do. The feedback for the previous show has been brilliant. I'm so glad that people are digging the slight move backwards in time to do some more of the kind of classic horror stuff. It's been pretty awesome and very gratifying to know that you guys are digging the shows, and I hope you continue digging them through these next 9 weeks, because there's a lot of really cool movies still to come up. But that's not the only show you're going to be getting this week. Obviously, Podcast Under the Stairs episode 61 has dropped, but you're being treated to a double bill this week. We're going to be kicking off Baz v Horror episode number 18, I think it is, where the Baz starts his look at the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. Yeah, that's right, the first 3 Nightmare on Elm Street movies will be coming up on a Baz v Horror this Thursday, so keep your eyes and your ears peeled for that one. That one was a lot of fun. However, it does kind of make you scratch your head and wonder how Baz managed to get to the age he is without seeing any Nightmare on Elm Street films. Makes you wonder kind of how deprived that guy's childhood was. We may have to sit him down on the couch on his second year anniversary and crack his head open and pry into it a little bit more. I don't get it. Maybe there wasn't enough shield in there for me, and that's how I saw them at a tender age. But yes, that is also going to be kicking off, and we're going to be running through the entire franchise plus the remake and Freddy vs Jason before we hit Baz v Halloween. So, and on Thursday's show, we'll be announcing the movies that Baz will be tackling this year on Baz v Halloween, and I'm not going to lie, some of these movies are going to challenge him in ways which he did not think movies could. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump out, I want to keep these intros quite short, and move into the meat of this top 10, which is obviously the two movie reviews. So I'm going to jump out just now. You're going to hear promos for shows that I love. You're going to hear our intro for Vincent Price v Christopher Lee. And when I return, I'm going to be joined by my guest, Mike Merriman, right after this.
Do you like movie reviews that are insightful, thought-provoking, and delivered by somebody who's trained to critically dissect every aspect of a motion picture without ever having to use obscenities?
Then you've got the wrong f***ing show. Kruger Nation Horror Podcast is ready to feed your slasher movie and exploitation needs. There'll be more blood, expletives, and titties than you can shake your grandma's beetle flaps at. Visit www.krugernation.com.
Oh, good God! A butthole casserole!
May I have your attention, please?
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely. I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
Ready to give the people what they want. Sensation, horror, shock.
Then tell us where Makata is.
Fear causes tremendous tensions in the body. If you can't relieve those tensions, why can't they become strong enough to kill you?
They will be destroyed.
Oh, splendid. This must be my malaria.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic, but scream! Scream for your lives!
I intended a peaceful occupation, but you have made that impossible.
You suspect foul play?
It's almost time to lock up the house. Then your party will really begin. I wonder how it'll end.
I will flog every person in this village.
You are about to enter hell.
You will warn the crew that if any one of them lets slip what really happened to the Armada, I will personally cut out his tongue.
Salt and mercury, effective against the dark forces. They will protect you and Simon. If we can save him.
The mark of Satan is upon them.
I appreciate the fact that you are here to help me. Nevertheless, I would remind you that you are also a guest in my house.
Welcome, fool. You have come of your own free will to the appointed place. Again, no.
The pit! The pen.
It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
And welcome back. So it's time to talk movies. So this is number 9 in the countdown of the top 10 Christopher Lee versus Vincent Price performances as selected by myself. We've got two fantastic films to discuss, House of Usher, or The Fall of the House of Usher if you're in the UK, from 1960, and Dr. Terror's House of Horrors from 1965. Joining me on number 9 on the countdown is my good friend Mike Merriman from Evil Episodes and the Not So Evil Episode Sidecast. How you doing, sir?
I am doing bright and shiny on a Sunday morning out here in California. I always love recording with you because we do it for my time. It's so early in the morning that it's like it's out of the way. I got the whole rest of the day ahead of me. Talking horror in the morning. It's something great to wake up to.
And we have recorded, the people out there may remember, we recorded a whole episode, and thanks to my delightful Mac hating me, it somehow managed to delete that episode. I don't know how that happened. It's probably me by accident, but I'm blaming my computer because that's what we do. So there is an episode being lost in the ether somewhere, so it's good to get you back, making finally your official full episode debut on the podcast Under the Stairs. Can you let the listeners know where they can check out your shows, please?
Sure. Right now, like you said, Evil Episodes, where we have a heavy discussion of TV horror on there. It can be heard on Horrorphilia, Network and Legion Network. The website itself, evilepisodes.com, I took it down for a little bit. It's going to be relaunching in the future, but I just want to make some tweaks to it. And I found that most people are listening to it off the both network feeds anyway. So that's where you can get it. iTunes, Stitcher, all those good streaming apps. So check that out. Sidecast, same places as well. The Sidecast is non-horror specific, although horror does come up time to time. We basically pick a theme each month, and the four hosts pick a movie according to that theme. So those are the two shows. And then I guess if you look for the Evil Episodes group page on Facebook, which I believe if you just type in Evil Episodes Podcast, that'll come up. That's where you can see anything else I pop up on as far as guest spots. So yeah, that's about it. Fun shows, and I like talking TV horror. There's a bunch of it going on now, so never a shortage there.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a wealth to mine just now. It's indeed the golden age of TV at the moment. So yeah, but we are talking about some golden age of horror as well on this episode. Two completely different sorts of movies here. And the first one we will be discussing, you're going to hear the trailer just momentarily, is one of the Roger Corman ones. In fact, it was the one that kicked it all off, of his Poe adaptations featuring Vincent Price. This one is The Fall of the House of Usher, or House of Usher if you were in the States, from 1960. That trailer is coming up right now. We're going to be coming right back after that to discuss the film right after this. ...72 movies that shocked a nation and made an infamous list, the Video Nasties. Hi, I'm Duncan McLeish, and you can join me and my co-host, Andy Blockley...
Hello, hello.
...as we chat about the 72 films, reviewing them all from the Video Nasty list, live on our podcast. Tell them about it, Andy.
Okay, 1982, 20,000 films were seized in London alone because they were too nasty to be watched. Come and find out why.
That's right. The show's called Doing the Nasty Podcast. You can find it exclusively on the Horrorphilia Network of podcasts. Come and check us out.
Incomparable genius of Edgar Allan Poe could knit them so closely together. The burning passions of the purest of loves. The deadly passions of the madly prurient.
Madeline, you're leaving this house with me tomorrow.
Only I could.
For hundreds of years, evil thoughts and evil deeds have been committed within these walls. The house itself is evil now.
Here they all are. Ushers.
This is monstrous.
It waits for me, because very soon I shall be dead.
Oh, Madeline, come away with me now.
You buried your own sister alive!
I did. But she's dead now.
The master hand of the macabre creates its masterpiece.
Thank you.
welcome back. So this is number 9 in the top 10 countdown of Christopher Lee versus Vincent Price on the podcast Under the Stairs, joined by Mike Merriman, and we're going to be discussing this first movie from 1960 called The House of Usher. This was directed by Roger Corman, based on the story by Edgar Allan Poe, but the screenplay was an adaptation done by Richard Matheson. It stars Vincent Price, Mark Damon, Mariner Ferry, and Harry Ellerber. I think that's how you pronounce those names. They're not good old-fashioned names, like Smith. So, the synopsis for this movie: a man, upon entering his fiancée's family mansion, discovers a savage family curse that fears that his future brother-in-law has entombed his bride-to-be prematurely. This one, I think... just kicking off, obviously, this one falls under the Vincent Price category. The next movie we'll be talking about is on the Christopher Lee side. But this one, to me, and I'm possibly going to get a lot of flack for putting this one on my list and not The Mask of the Red Death. But I would just like to put forward that I think that Vincent Price's performance in this one just ebbs out Mask of the Red Death when it comes to the Poe adaptations. It's not my favourite performance in the Poe adaptations, because later on in this list, somewhere further down the line, I will be doing Pit in the Pendulum, which I think is... I tend to gravitate more towards Price being an absolute evil bastard in movies. I think that's where they shine, and I think his dementedness in Pit in the Pendulum is just like, it's a tour de force. However, there's something very understated about his performance in House of Usher, and that's why it makes this list over Mask of the Red Death. And I'm just getting that out of the way just now, because basically the synopsis covers things pretty well here. Man appears at a large stately house, or castle, or mansion, depending on which way you look at it. He's there to see his fiancée. He's told that she is not taking any visitors at the behest of her brother, who will not have anyone visiting at all. He plays Roderick Usher, that's Vincent Price, and he's basically keeping everyone out of the way because he believes that there is this curse on the House of Usher, which will die out with him and his sister. Basically, he finds a way of getting into the house anyway, and basically weird things ensue in this movie. It's a very, very simplistic, very, very straightforward movie, but I think it's underpinned by some incredible acting, especially by Vincent Price rocking some weird peroxide blonde hair and a stunning red jacket. I've got the Blu-ray for this, and the colour correction is phenomenal. It's very vibrant, it's very over the top, it's very gothic, it's very Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe. Mike, you'd seen this one before, no doubt. What's your thoughts on House of Usher?
Yeah, I think with this movie, it's two things. I think the acting that carries this, and I love the set of the house. It's like your prototypical creepy gothic house. You know, it's a little dirty, a little danky. You go down the stairs, there's dust, there's cobwebs, there's always a hall that leads to something else. I have not seen this in a long time. I think, you know, it's probably one of those movies that the first time I saw it, I was a little too young to appreciate it. A little bit slower paced. There's, you know, the little mystery aspect to this one as far as what exactly is going on. How evil is Vincent Price? Is he being truthful about trying to protect from the curse? Is there something more sinister going on? But this movie, it is enjoyable. I did enjoy it a bunch rewatching it for the show. And yeah, Vincent Price, the hair. I was wondering that too, because I was like, 1960, how old does that put him? Is it the hair that's making him look like a lot older than he even actually is at that time? But yeah, that bleach, they were going crazy with the bleach for that. And I mean, if you're familiar with Vincent Price, Vincent Price is being Vincent Price here. And something, anyone that's in the horror movie fan, or I would say Vincent Price might be one of those guys that even transcends people who don't necessarily watch horror, but that voice and look are very unique. It's probably a voice that people have heard. You know, he is on the Thriller song.
Yes, that's
the Thriller. So that puts it to where almost everyone's probably heard his voice at least. It stands out. He's one of those figures that probably everyone has at least come across, you know, a couple times in their life, whether they knew it was him or not. But he is definitely being Vincent Price here, and that's one thing about him as an actor and the characters he plays. He really stands out on screen when you watch him, and you usually want, when you're seeing him, you want more scenes with him no matter what.
Yeah. I think there's something very, I mean, there's a couple of things that aid the performance here. The quirk of his character being, he's got this intense, he has intense headaches, which are caused by the fact that the curse has inflicted on him some sort of really superior superhuman hearing. So he can hear every crack, every creak, and like you were saying, the setting of the house is phenomenal. Very much in keeping with all the movies that come after this, and the kind of Corman Poe adaptation stuff, is very rich, bright colours, which I think work really well in this. And Price plays, like you say, basically plays like Vincent Price. A lot of his roles are very similar, but that's kind of what you're looking for here, especially the sinister way the character takes a turn. Because, and once again, like you picked up on there, the cool thing about this movie is that if you've never seen it before, there is this ambiguity as to whether or not he's actually telling the truth, mm-hmm. whether or not this is actually all in his head, or, you know, is it real? And certainly from the fiancé's point of view, Philip, who's played by Mark Damon, he is of the opinion that the reason his fiancé is not well is because she's been kept against her will in a house, fed gruel. And, you know, this is what's keeping her there, because he met her not that long before and she was radiant, etc. And it's only coming back to the house that this has caused this problem. And there's a lot in this movie that leads you down that direction. I mean, Vincent Price, you know, his character Roderick is very over the top and incredibly paranoid and, you know, very suspicious. And he never really justifies anything up with a reason, suffice to say that there's a curse on the family. And I think that's, you know, I think that plays quite well. It's only really when you get towards the very end of the movie that you realise that, you know, Price has been telling the truth. He's just been going a very extreme way around to try and put it forward, because at one point in this movie we believe that his sister has died, mm-hmm. And when she's in a coffin, Price observes her fingers moving, and he closes the door anyway and has her committed to her tomb or crypt in the building footprint downstairs in the basement. And then we later find out from the butler, Bristol, I think his name was, we find out from him that she suffers from a rare affliction, which basically means that she could be perceived as being dead but still be alive. And then we have this kind of frantic chase from the fiancé to try and find out where her body has been buried. And ultimately, when they arrive there, she is gone. And that's when things take this sinister turn, that we realise that she has indeed gone crazy. Whether or not that's at the hands of Vincent Price from locking her in a coffin, which, you know, somebody would argue, if you've been trapped in a coffin for a day, maybe you come out a bit crazy, I don't know. But the other alternative is that when you see her at the end, she looks almost demonic. And I think that the ending of the movie, incredibly bleak, as a lot of these, a lot of the Poe stuff is, they seldom have a happy ending, but ultimately the two of them dying in a burning building, thus finishing the line of the House of Usher. It's quite powerful as well, I think. I think that works really well in this movie.
Yeah, and just to go back to Vincent Price for a sec, it's I think it's the strength of his acting that you don't quite know how much of the truth he's telling or if he's behind something more sinister. And I think that's just a strength of his playing this kind of character with his presence. And there's multiple times in the movie where you think it could go either way, with either he is up to something or he's just telling the truth and he's trying to end the family curse. So big ups to him.
Yeah, it's good casting. I mean, Price, like, even by 1960, was famed for playing kind of the horror villain, you know, the debonair, suave, sophisticated horror villain. So by putting him in this role, it's very easy from an audience member who has seen multiple Vincent Price movies to instantly think there's something suspicious about his character, to instantly think he is the villain. And let's not sway away from things here. He's not exactly a nice guy in this movie. He is quite sadistic, and yeah, he does bury his sister alive. And so, he's no angel or saint in this movie, but at the same time, the curse that he keeps banging on about, you know, is ultimately revealed to be true. So he's not a liar either. I think this kind of kicks off this. I mean, this movie rather famously has been committed to the Museum of Film. I think it's the only one from the kind of Corman Poe adaptations, because this was the one that kicked it off, and this really sets the groundwork for, you know, a legacy of films that are incredibly strong kind of Poe adaptations, and some of them less so. I think they do start stretching quite a bit to try and kind of fit the Poe short story or poem into the movies, or they take liberties with certain things. And Richard Matheson's screenplay transformation of the story is excellent, and it serves up those wonderful lines that you could struggle to think of any other actor to deliver the lines that Price does other than Price. There's something very gothic about the way everything in this movie feels, even down to his acting. This kind of very, kind of a form of English that we don't usually hear in films, especially in the 1960s, and the way he delivers it as well, the poignancy, the lighting, the colours, it just all works in this movie for me. I just think everything, you know, fires on full cylinders. And you know, if you happen to have this one, like I say, on Blu-ray, and you get that ability to see how well they've managed to do the colour correction, the remaster, even the soundtrack, the score in this movie is phenomenal. I think it all just works in one great package. And ultimately the success of this one wasn't made for a lot of money, and classic Corman, none of them are made for a lot of money, but the success of this movie, you know, generates this ability for him to go on and create more adaptations based on the works of Poe and featuring Vincent Price. And he, you can tell he's having a lot of fun in this movie. He's really kind of relishing the role, whether it's him sitting playing his lute or discussing his rather outrageous painting, which doesn't look like any painting that would happen in that time period. It certainly looks like a kind of more modern 60s style painting, with its vibrant kind of purples and pinks and kind of colour wash that it has. But it just all seems to work effortlessly in this movie. I mean, it is so minimalist. You're talking about a cast of maybe four people in the movie, and relying on four people to carry a movie which is, you know, almost an hour and a half long, is very difficult at the best times. But when you see it in this setup, the casting's perfect. And yeah, Price is pretty phenomenal in this movie. I don't think I can stress this enough. I think he really kind of, you know, really sells it. I mean, from the moment you see him in the movie, the very first kind of introduction to him, kind of sitting, hand on forehead, anguished in his parlour, right up to the very end with him and his sister. I think it's a great roller coaster, and I think the movie flows really well as well. I think it's one of those ones that, very much like yourself, Mike, I think I saw when I must have been under 10 years old, just a kid when I saw this movie for the first time. And I remember seeing it with my grandparents and just being like, maybe not fully taking in the full gravity of the story, but just being captivated by what was happening on the screen. I thought it was fantastic. So, yeah, I think, I mean, just going to a wider question, just because I've not got a chance to speak to you on any of the other Poe Corman adaptations, do you have a favourite? Is this your favourite, or do you fall into the you know, the Mask of the Red Death, or the Pit and the Pendulum, or Tomb of Ligeia? You know, are these more?
I fall into the have not seen a lot of them category, actually.
Oh, right.
So, you know. Much like House of Usher, I have probably seen bits and pieces of a bunch of them throughout my younger years, because when we would have like the local network playing horror movies like all night long on a Friday night, a bunch of those would always show up on there. But to really have sat down and watched them all the way through like I did House of Usher, I don't think I have for a lot of them. But after watching this one, my interest has definitely peaked. Because you said this isn't even your favorite one, so I'm interested to watch some of the other ones now. Definitely.
Yeah, it'd be cool. It'd be cool to if you do get a chance to check out another one, so you definitely come back and let us know. I think there's good ones. Certainly by the time they were nearing the end, they'd really kind of ran it into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
With the occasional Price really being the main kind of standout in each of them, but even then at times he looked a bit tired of doing the same sort of thing over and over again. But there's certainly some fantastic ones in there. Anything else you want to say about this movie before we take a short break and then return with Dr. Terror's House of Horror, which is a bit of a tongue twister if ever there was one?
I would just say, for those unfamiliar with this genre or even this movie specifically, give it a shot. Like I said, I would say, you know, Vincent Price, I think he's one of those guys where everyone recognizes him as an icon, but I would bet that a lot of people haven't actually seen a lot of his stuff. At least from this era, you know, but I think this movie is, a good one to get started with, you know, maybe a little different from some of the usual villains he plays. But I think, you know, I think this one was really good. It was really entertaining. And I have more stuff to say about Vincent Price, but I think I'll save that when we get into our our verses.
Yeah, right at the very end. So we're going to take a short break just now. You're going to hear the trailer for our second and final movie review. The one that falls into the camp of Christopher Lee. It's Dr. Terror's House of Horror from 1965. We're going to be right back after this.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
House of Horrors. Horrors the screen has never before dared to depict. The terrifying horror of man killing blind with a human brain that creeps and kills. The terrifying horror of the dead, entombed for 200 years, that creeps its way back to terrorize the living. The terrifying horror of a dreaded man called Dr. Terror, who, with his deck of mystic cards, could foretell destiny. Dr. Terror's House of Horrors.
And welcome back. So you've just heard the trailer for our second and final movie review, Dr. Terror's House of Horror from 1965. I was just saying to Mike off air, the lost episode that we recorded had an anthology movie. The movie escapes me now.
Was it Night Train to Terror?
Night Train to Terror, that was it. So Night Train to Terror was the name of that movie, and it was awful. It was an anthology set in a train. This one, this is what I think it maybe was trying to aspire to be, but failing greatly on.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Terror's House of Horror came out in 1965. This is an Amicus production, a rather famous company that put out quite a lot of movies. This was directed by Freddie Francis. The writer of the screenplay was Milton Dobsky. This movie has quite the ensemble cast. We have Christopher Lee, Roy Castle, Peter Cushing, Max Adrian, Michael Goff. We also have a rather young debonair Donald Sutherland just kicking it. And yeah, like I said, this one is an anthology. The synopsis is: aboard a British train, mysterious fortune teller Dr. Shrek uses tarot cards to read the future of five fellow passengers. So, this is a movie I saw, I think I want to say about 10 years ago for the first time, on an absolutely terrible, terrible rip of this movie. And I have actually purchased the Blu-ray, so I can't wait for that to arrive. Odeon's putting out the Blu-ray in the UK. So very much looking forward to that. My good friend Graham Humphreys, the guy that did my poster, has designed the cover art for it. It's wicked. So can't wait for that. Unfortunately, in the interim, I had to watch this one on YouTube. But I was quite surprised at the fantastic version on YouTube. It was a really quite immaculate cut of it. Like I said, this is an anthology. Basically, we are introduced to Peter Cushing, who... the beauty of doing this show, these run of shows, is that the majority of the Christopher Lee movies I picked also star Peter Cushing. And had I had the opportunity, if it wasn't going to be so complicated, to have made this a three-way Peter Cushing versus Christopher Lee versus Vincent Price, I would have done so. But the fact I'm getting so many performances by him as I work my way through this is making me very happy. And a kind of twist to the roles. We are given Peter Cushing playing the kind of more sadistic dark role, and Christopher Lee playing, well, you could argue, maybe not the nicest guy in the world, but I don't know. So he is a fortune teller who boards a train, enters a carriage with five passengers. Some of them are quite receptive to having their tarot read, Christopher Lee being the main naysayer, who's not interested at all, very rational man, doesn't want anything to do with it. And we go through each of the characters' tarots being told in the form of like a flash forward sort of story. He's reading their future. There is, in this one, obviously five segments. One called The Werewolf, the second one called The Creeping Vine, the third one is called Voodoo, the fourth one is called Disembodied Hand, and the fifth one is Vampire. Now, obviously, with this being an anthology, Christopher Lee is not one of the main characters in this one, but features as a main character within the story. So at the end, when we discuss the pros and cons of who was the better performer, we will focus probably more on just that segment, The Disembodied Hand. But in terms of this one, how did you get on with this one, Mike? Had you seen this one before?
I had never seen this one before, but that's unfortunate because I really did enjoy it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's funny, too, that at the beginning of this segment, you said if it would have been so difficult, you might have made it a three-way contest between Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, and Peter Cushing. Because as I was starting to watch this movie, and you kind of have Cushing and Lee going, or, you know, playing off of each other, I almost for a second forgot. I was like, is this Price versus Lee or Price versus... because, they're both, when you see them both in any movie playing well off each other. And in this one, like you said, the kind of role reversal with Lee. Lee, even though he's kind of a jerk, he's still playing the more straight guy, and yeah, Cushing, the tarot card reader, with, you know, a little sinister twist there. But I had not seen this one before, and I had heard of it, you know, through the years, just hadn't gotten around to watching it. But who doesn't love a good anthology, right? I was very pleased with this movie. I thought, none of the stories I thought were really weak. I mean, I like some, better than others, but I didn't really have any story where I was like, oh, let's get on with it. I enjoyed pretty much the movie all the way through. And by the end, you have maybe an idea of where it's going, but it was still pretty cool. And I love how, like, the newspaper comes flying down out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Get their little headline. That was funny. But, yeah, overall, I enjoyed this one a lot.
Yeah, this one, to me, is one of those kind of rare occurrences where you get an anthology where pretty much every single one of them, you know, are of a higher standard. Some are excellent, but there's none that are poor. I totally agree with what you say. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that each of the stories are kind of strictly timed, because we're getting five stories and a wrap around here, and the movie's on for about an hour and 40 minutes. There isn't a lot of time to fuck around, really. So we basically are getting these very quick, maybe 10 to 15 minute stories. In between the wraparound, and this is a really cool wraparound. I love this. I love Taro, actually, just in general. I think Taro is one of these things that it never really gets used anymore in favour of things like Ouija boards and things in movies, but there's something quite sinister about a fortune teller turning over the death card, which we see a lot in this movie. I think Peter Cushing is phenomenal in this. I actually think everyone plays really well, even if you get away from some of the generic Scottish accent and the English accent. I can't complain about Donald Sutherland because he is an American, but I don't think the guy that was doing the Scottish accent was Scottish, or any of those cool people were Scottish either. Just saying, not that I have a bugbearer or that or a grudge with that at all. But yeah, I think the cool thing about this one is it covers a couple of the more traditional kind of horror stories here with the werewolf and the vampire, but kind of mixes it up with some of the newer things as well, like voodoo, etc. Basically, through each of our, I don't want to go too in detail into each of the short stories, but each of the short stories are set up in such a way that our character who's having his tarot read, it's something he's going to be doing in the future, and there's this inevitability that something bad is going to happen to them, and that's why the tarot's being read. So our first character travels back to a kind of old family house, which is cursed with a werewolf, and things kind of unfold in a slightly unpredictable way there. And the second one, which is a very kind of Twilight Zone-esque one, we have a vine that is apparently evolved beyond self-preservation to the point that it knows exactly how to cut telephone lines and abduct, kill dogs and kill people through windows. And our third movie, which I really like, actually. I really dig the third one because I think the premise is really cool. The execution is maybe not as great, but I thought the story in itself is about a musician who's desperately trying to find that next big song. While he's on holiday,
or vacation,
he comes across a voodoo tribe and he transcribes the song they're playing, even though he's told not to because the voodoo god they're praying to is quite a vengeful one. But he transcribes it anyway, brings it back and swings it into the form of jazz.
Don't you love that scene too when he's kind of watching the tribe form it from afar, and then every time it cuts back to him, there's like one more member over his shoulder.
Yeah.
that was really good.
It's just brilliant.
It's simple, but it's good. Like sometimes things like that where, you know, there's no special effect, nothing crazy going on, but just kind of the camera shot with like one more guy, and you know the trouble's mounting for him.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think it's just once again, it's those things that are just really simple, but the execution's really well. So he brings this song back anyway. He's performing it in his jazz club. Weird things start to happen. Windows start blowing open. Extreme winds start blowing through. And things are a bit creepy. And his friend tries to recommend that he gets rid of the song, but he takes it anyway. And when he goes home, he is haunted by the voodoo kind of ghost who then ultimately, I'm assuming, kills him. We're not quite sure.
At first, I was like, did he just pass out from fear? But maybe I think he well, I guess in order to make the end of the wraparound
work, it must happen. So he dies of fright, basically, and the voodoo spirit takes the music away and walks out the door. So that's our third one. Our fourth one is just genius. I love this. The Christopher Lee one. It is the main reason it got picked for this top 10. I love this story. So Lee plays this art critic who is, like some critics can be, particularly mean. And he has this bugbear with this one particular artist who he's at an exhibition of and is making a mockery of his work. And the artist decides to play a trick on him by getting his assistant to bring out a painting which wasn't painted by him. Christopher Lee endorses it, says it's wonderful, it's bold, etc. He asks to see the painter and they bring out a monkey. This obviously humiliates Christopher Lee, who then leaves and tries to get back onto his life of appearing at galas, delivering speeches. But this painter hems him, and wherever the painter shows up, whether it's when he's trying to perform a speech in front of his peers, and this guy's created like a paper cut out of all these monkeys holding hands, which distracts him, or where he's trying to deliver a speech at another local gallery, and he shows up there, which puts him off. And ultimately, this enrages Lee to the point where Lee runs him over in a hit and run. But causes the artist to lose his hand, his painting hand. And obviously, he feels a bit guilty, but not that much guilty about it. And this artist, his life is destroyed at this point, so much so that he eats a bullet. And Christopher Lee seems a bit more tormented by that. And the manifestation of that is that he's followed by the Sever Hand, which he disposes in a lot of different ways, whether it's throwing it from the car, burning it, stabbing it, putting it in a box and flinging it. It gets very kind of Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote in terms of the ways that he tries to dispose of this hand. And the hand ultimately appears at the end and once again makes him crash his car. And the twist or irony of this story, which is once again very Twilight Zone, is that Christopher Lee's character survives, but is blinded. So his tool, his artistic tool, which is his eyes, how he sees the world to write about, is taken away from him, mirroring the artist who lost his hand. I think there's something very wonderfully drab and droll about this one, and I think Lee's performance is brilliant. There's a particular sequence in this where the hand crawls through his parlour and grabs his ankle, and Lee's portrayal of fear in this one is fantastic. It's the only movie I think you'll ever see where you see Lee play scared against something, and it's wonderful. It's so realistic, he looks terrified. And it goes to show the versatility of his acting. He's an actor that sometimes was very easily typecast as the cold, calculating villain. And they kind of play with it in this movie. I think it works wonderful. What did you think of the disembodied hand?
Yeah, a huge fan of this one. Like you said, since I had never seen this movie, I didn't know what was coming here, but it was great. I love the hand effects. I love all the ways he's trying to get rid of the hand, different ways to kill it. He thinks, okay, finally it's gone now, and it just shows up again. The hand burnt to a crisp shows back up. And yeah, I thought that ending, like you said, very Twilight Zone-y. It was great in that drab, depressing, dim outlook kind of way. And so I think it's they're loading him like an ambulance. Oh, but he's never gonna see again.
just hear him go no from the back of
that.
Which is exactly the same reaction of the artist when the artist wakes up and looks down at his hand and sees a stump.
Mm-hmm.
He gives it the same cry of pain. I think it's really clever, not in the way of, you know, this is the most original story, because it's not, because there's a lot of movies that had done this before, and like I say, Twilight Zone was very apt at doing that kind of taking a character and then almost putting them through the thing they did not want to be put through, to ultimately end up with, you know, a scenario where what they have inflicted on someone else is inflicted on them. So I mean, it's not, it wasn't breaking it, but I just think it's a it's a bold casting choice to put Christopher Lee in this one. You wouldn't expect Christopher Lee to be playing this sort of character, certainly the sort of character he is at the start, but not at the end. And you can see that, you know, there's, you don't have to stretch that far forward to see how things like, even anthologies like Creepshow take this idea of the elements within the disembodied hand to use it, whether it's the, you know, the hitchhiker one, you know, Thanks for the Ride Lady, which is basically a kind of more condensed one shot, you know, or sorry, one set piece shot idea of that, you know, instead of, you know, Christopher Lee going to all these different places and being followed by a hand. In the case of that one, it's her being followed by the hitchhiker she knocks over. So, I mean, it's used in other things as well. I just think it's, it works really well, and it, like, compared to the other stories, this one really kind of, this one kind of breaks things up for the final story, which I think Vampire is also one of these ones which is just, it's the perfect way to finish it, the short stories, because we have Donald Sutherland's character, who's a doctor, he's recently married, brings his wife back to his house. He is living in a town with, he's quite a prevalent doctor, but there's another one as well. There's a series of weird things occurring, and this other doctor kind of writes it off in a kind of off-the-cuff manner that, you know, had this been a couple of centuries ago, you know, he would have thought that maybe it was a vampire. And this idea of the vampire keeps getting put into his head, to the point where the doctor, the other doctor, kind of convinces Donald Sutherland that his wife is actually a vampire. And to be fair, the story's played out in such a way that the audience is also convinced that the woman's a vampire. I mean, one of the first clips we get to see of her is her tending to the wound of her husband. He's cut his finger and she's sucking the blood from his finger. So the, all the way through it, strange things seem to happen with this vampire sort of thing, you know, about the same time. And it's tied up really cleverly at the end, because he, Donald Sutherland ultimately kills his wife with a stake. And then when he tries, when he's getting arrested for it, he basically says to the other doctor, come on, you told me. And he plays ignorant with this, you know, I don't know what you're on about. So he gets arrested and taken away. And then we find out that not only was his wife actually a vampire, because of the what the doctor says at the very end, but the doctor did it all because he wants to be the only doctor. So he's like, there can only be one doctor in this town, and one vampire. And at that, he turns into a bat and flies away. So he's basically played Donald Sutherland in a way to get rid of his character as a doctor, but also the wife, who we can only assume was a vampire. Or maybe she wasn't. You can look at it maybe from the point of view that maybe he's done everything so he will kill his wife to be arrested. I don't know. I think the fact that he says at the end, you know, there's only room in this time for one doctor, one vampire, I've always taken away that maybe his wife was a vampire.
That's what I took from it too, and what an excellent ending. I mean, everything leading up to that was perfectly satisfying, and then the fact that the twist is he is a vampire, and he used Donald Sutherland, played him like a fool to take care of his problem for him. Oh, just great.
It's really cool. And meanwhile, our Lincoln story has been that Peter Cushing, or Dr. Terror, or Dr. Shrek, he has been turning over the cards, and each time he goes to turn over the fifth card, it's the death card, which you won't show them for the first little while, and then ultimately they get wise to this, they grab his hand and see that he's delivering the death card, and they ask him at the very end to do the same thing to himself, and he, instead of turning over the four cards before, he shuffles them to the bottom and turns his card to show that he has also dealt with the death card. And when they question him on it, he basically says, you know, you should have maybe figured out who I am by now. And then he disappears. And obviously, if you've been quite savvy up to that point, you've worked out he is the Grim Reaper. But they think that they're safe because he's went away. They're going to be safe on the train. The train comes into its stop. And like you said earlier on, they leave the train to find out that They're in some sort of purgatory, and this newspaper flies down to say that five people have died in a train crash. And we can only assume it's those five people. And that's the end of the movie. I have a lot of fun with this one. I think it's as well paced. I think it's well acted. I think maybe not all the short stories are amazing. The last two are certainly the strongest two, but I don't think any of them are bad. I don't think they suffer from a pacing issue either, because they're quite rightly locked into that 10-15 minutes tops to do the story. And like I say, I quite like the fact that it kind of dabbles with some of the more older established kind of universal horror sort of ideas of vampires and werewolves, but at the same time covers more of the kind of the more modern things that were kind of kicking in with the 50s and 60s in terms of horror through things like voodoo. Which I quite liked as well. And like I say, I have a lot of fun with it. I think it's just very well shot, very well casted, very well acted. A very solid kind of anthology. Amicus did a lot of anthologies after this, because this one was a bit of a success. But it's a very solid one that I think is sometimes overlooked.
Yeah, well, it's definitely overlooked by me because I hadn't seen it before. I think, yeah, a great point. What makes this one, the pacing's great. I think by the end of it, you might not even realize you watched five stories and a wraparound story. I think that's when I was, before we started recording, and I'm kind of playing everything back in my head, getting ready to, when you know you're going to be discussing it, and I'm like, all right, the anthology. You're so used to now, like, three being kind of like the standard. And I was like, whoa, there was five stories and a wraparound. And it just zoomed by when I watched it. And I think that's a great trait in a anthology. If you can get through it and you didn't realize that there was that many stories, that's a job well done. And I think also having a wraparound story like this, that's very interesting. And you don't 100% know. I mean, by the end, by the last couple segments of it, you kind of get a good idea where it's going. But I still felt that the ending to the wraparound story was very satisfying. And it was good. And like you said, this movie, there's a lot of recognizable faces in it. So I think just right off the bat, people will be happy. As soon as the movie opens up and we get our group on the train, you're like, oh, it's him.
yeah, you're working your way around them. And I mean, there's worse ways to be delivered an anthology movie than your Crypt Keeper in this one, being played by Peter Cushing. It's a delight to watch him. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. It really is a delight to watch him and Christopher Lee play off each other. They were great friends, and acted in God knows how many movies, and there's a chemistry there that you just don't need to worry about right from the start. And I think that's why in the movie, you know, Christopher Lee in the Lincoln scenes has more lines than any other character against Peter Cushing, because he's acting against his friend, which I think works. I genuinely think it's one of those diamonds in the rough that, like you said, even if you haven't seen it, it flies in. It might sound, when someone's saying there's five short stories in a wraparound, that might seem like it might be a long, bothersome or kind of a chore to watch, and it's really not. I think the beauty of this one is that it does flow so quickly right through to the very end. So, anything else you want to say about it?
I'd just say, once I knew they wanted to cast Christopher Lee in this movie, you knew it had to be the character, the skeptic he played, so him and Peter Cushing could play off each other. That alone makes the wraparound great. And I would just say, this movie, like Duncan mentioned, it's on YouTube right now. It's easily accessible. I would say it's another one of those movies from that era that if you're not familiar with it, check it out. It doesn't feel like dated to me, the stories. I think part of it is because they, even though it deals with a lot of the classic horror villains or monsters, it takes a much more modern approach to the twists and turns of how they play out in the story. You know, it's not just your typical, like, you know, for example, vampire. It's not just a vampire going into people's houses at night, killing people. They take a very modern twist and apply it to the real world, you know, and a lot of unique stuff in here. Some stuff not so unique, but it's still very good, a very easy watch and easily accessible. So there's really no excuse not to check this one out.
Fantastic, fantastic. We're going to take our final break of these movie reviews. When we return, me and Mike are going to discuss who had the better performance in these movies, who will be walking away with the points, and this, number 9 on my Christopher Lee versus Vincent Price series, the top 10, we're going to be right back after this.
You know those old-time radio shows with the married couples who bicker about the kids and the car and the neighbors? Our podcast is a lot like that.
Yeah, well, if you replace the kids, the car, and the neighbors with devil movies, theology, and vodka.
My name is X.
And I'm Cootie.
And we are the hosts of Kiss the Goat, a different kind of movie podcast.
Every episode, we review a devil movie. You know, possessions, exorcisms, the Antichrist, and we stomp a mud hole in it, even if we like it.
We are huge fans of comparative religion, and we love to compare real belief systems with what Hollywood seems to think belief systems are.
But don't think we're not civic-minded, because each episode includes our Satan in the News segment, where our fearless correspondent, Sin Fallon, documents the eternal struggle between good and evil.
And, as high-functioning alcoholics, we give every movie its own drinking game, so that you can enjoy the movie just like we did. Ripped to the tits.
And there is ever so much more to the show than that. And let me tell you, it ain't for kids.
Well, it ain't for most adults.
But it might be for you.
You won't know until you listen to Kiss the Goat exclusively on the Legion Network of Podcasts.
That's Kiss the Goat. We're the lighter side
of the dark side.
And welcome back. So, we have discussed The House of Usher from 1960. We have discussed Dr. Terror's House of Horrors from 1965. We have once again been treated to another fantastic Vincent Price performance and another fantastic Christopher Lee performance. The question now is posed, who was the better performer in their movie? And this one to me, as much as I was raving about how much I love The House of Usher, and I do love The House of Usher, I'm going to come in with Christopher Lee in this one, because I think, and there's a reason behind it, I come in with Christopher Lee because I think in this one we get to see a performance style of Christopher Lee that you genuinely wouldn't see in most of his career. We get to see a better kind of arch of that performance. So we start with him being very stuck as being very cold and very clinical, and through the experiences of this one being terrified, and ultimately paranoid and scared by the end. I think there's a greater story arc for that character, which I think Christopher Lee performs really well in. And yeah, I think that's maybe what clinches it for me, as I think the performance has maybe more dexterity and versatility over Vincent Price. And that's not to say that I don't like Vincent Price. I think Vincent Price's performance is very captivating in The House of Usher. I think he does play that sort of, like we were saying, he plays one style of acting through it, that Vincent Price style of acting through it, but he does it in such a subtle way that for most of the movie you're forgiven for thinking that he's bullshitting the audience, only to reveal at the end he's not, which I think is very clever. It works really well as well, but to me I just think Christopher Lee just pips this one. What about yourself, Mike? Who wowed you more in these two movies?
Well, okay, so for this matchup I gotta say it was a tough one, and I've gone back and forth a few times because I think with these two specific roles, you can both consider both the actors here kind of essential to the movies they're in. Vincent Price, because who else is going to play that role?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And as far as Christopher Lee goes, who else are you going to cast to go opposite Peter Cushing and play off him like that? So you kind of have a situation where, like, who could you see more easily replay? Well, okay, when I originally approached it, I was like, which one could you see more easily replaced and the movie still working? And I couldn't come up with a decision on that. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's just a tough question there. But ultimately, I have to say, I agree with you that Christopher Lee edged out slightly because this is kind of a departure from what you see from him. Vincent Price, he's excellent as always, but I think, you know, this is kind of the era of when you see Vincent Price on screen, you know what you're going to get. He's great at playing that kind of character, but for the purposes of the matchup of the versus aspect of this contest, when I'm watching Christopher Lee play kind of a different role than you're used to him seeing, I love how he plays off Peter Cushing, and I love him in his story. Just all around, I think if you were gonna put like these roles up against like their other work, I think Christopher Lee's is going to be more memorable as far as this character goes, because it's something you're not going to see from many of his other roles. As where Vincent Price, as good as he was, you know, you can probably find a bunch of other movies in his library of work that he's playing similar. You know, you're going to see that a lot from him.
Yeah,
Christopher Lee, I think it's more of the unique performance, something you don't get a lot, and that's kind of what edged him out. Just barely, though, because I did, you know, like I said, this was a tough one. So,
I appreciate it. They're going to get tougher as they go on as well. So I think that's the thing. They really are. There's a couple of lineups coming up down the road on these shows where I am going to hate myself for having to pick between one or the other, because I'm not allowed to say draw myself. But if my guest chooses one, I choose the other, that's fine. But I can't, you can't yourself say draw, which you kind of want to do in all these movies. I mean, you're blessed with two iconic horror actors, you know, guys that basically are the reason that, you know, we grew up interested in watching horror movies. Like, you watched Christopher Lee and you watched Vincent Price as a kid, and that's your gateway to, you know, on some level, they're movies that you can show kids now, even though at the time they were terrifying. They're movies you can show kids now, and kids, you know, will not bat an eyelid because they can see worse things on cartoons. So yeah, I'm extremely happy that you've joined me on this one. So Christopher Lee gets 2 points. And obviously when I close out the show, we'll be tallying them into the table to see who's currently in the lead. And how that shapes up for episode number 8, you know, number 8 in the countdown. Mike, if you would just like to refresh the memory of the listeners where they can check out your shows before you go.
Alright, sure. So, I've got Evil Episodes and the Not So Evil Sidecast can both be found on Horrorphilia Network, as well as Legion Podcast Network, Stitcher, iTunes, all that kind of good stuff. So, if you like TV horror and you like movies in general, check them out.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much, Mike. And I dare say we'll be seeing you once again back over on the podcast Under the Stairs somewhere down the line. Thanks very much for giving up some time to come over, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be back. And maybe next time we'll find like a third train related horror movie to talk about.
I'll work on it in the interim. I'll work on it. Right. I'm going to take a very short break just now. When I come back, I'm closing out the show right after this.
Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story.
They try to kill us.
You ungodly warlock.
But we just won't stay dead.
What's the matter? You can't hold your liquor, huh?
The Midnight Horror Show. The internet's goriest and raunchiest horror podcast since 2008. Now live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time at tmhsradio.com. Listen on your mobile device with the TuneIn app, search TMHS Radio, or download us at iTunes, Podomatic, or the TMHS Radio page.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs. And you've been listening to the podcast Under the Stairs. This has been episode number 61, number 9 in the top 10 Vincent Price versus Christopher Lee horror performances as selected by the podcast Under the Stairs, with reviews of The Fall of the House of Usher and Dr. Terror's House of Horror. Hope you really enjoyed that, and obviously we're now in that most awkward of positions where we're back level. 2 points to Christopher Lee and 2 points to Vincent Price. Who will win next week? Oh, I don't know. It's too tough to call, but my guess will help me. My guess next week is Mark Ball from the Midnight Horror Show. He's going to be on the show looking at, for the Christopher Lee movies, The Curse of Frankenstein. And in the Vincent Price category, we're going to be doing House on Haunted Hill. So two absolute corkers coming up next week. So make sure you keep your eyes and ears open for that. And obviously don't forget that this week we will also be dropping Baz v Horror 18, where Baz is going to be kicking off his look at the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, with the first three movies dropping on that show. It should be landing on Thursday, and it's a good one. Quick reminder at the end of the show that there are still plenty of posters out there for you to buy if you're interested in supporting the show and getting something to put on your wall to, I don't know, to look at, throw darts at, or put a voodoo hex curse over. Then you should buy one of those posters designed by Graham Humphreys, the great British horror artist, and also limited to 75 if you live in the UK. It's £12.50, and that includes your postage and packaging. If you live all the way over in the grand old US of A, it's $23. That also includes your postage and packaging. Like I say, numbered limited to 75. Once they're gone, they're gone, and all proceeds are helping us continue the show, which is like obviously something that hopefully you've a vested interest in, or maybe you don't. Maybe you want me to see me fail, crash and burn. One person once said, a very famous person, that's better to crash and burn than to fade away. I don't know, I quite like the idea of fading away. I'm just putting that out there. Burning, not so much. But yeah, so those posters are still available. If you're interested, you can message me directly on Facebook. I'll give you details on how to get it, or you can send us an email to podcastunderthestairs@gmail.com. Now, there is a multitude of ways to check out this show. You can listen to the show, obviously, on iTunes. If you do, why not leave us some feedback? If it's 5 stars, for example, those 5-star feedbacks help us bump up the iTunes ratings. It means that more people are likely to come across the show. You can listen to us on Stitcher Smart Radio through the website, which is podcastunderthestairs.wordpress.com. Like I said on many episodes, we are a proud member of Legion Podcast Network, so you can check us out with a multitude of fantastic shows over there on Legion. And you should go and listen to us there as well, because like I say, tons of fantastic shows. It's never been a better time to be a horror podcast listener. You're really spoiled with a wealth of fantastic shows out there. But without me pimping and going into all that, you know, you should leave me feedback and all the rest, I just really want to say thank you very much to everyone who has been downloading the shows, everyone that gets in touch, whether it's to drop us some fantastic feedback or pose a question on the page. There's lots of them that pop up, and they're always fun to look at. I even went as far as to post one myself this week, where I asked you to post from YouTube some of your favourite horror shocks, your your jump frights from movies, and that was a lot of fun actually. Rob Wilson opened my eyes to something I'd never seen before, so thanks very much, Rob. But obviously Jerry Esposito and the regulars over there keeping it real and letting me see some classic jump scares from horror cinema. Thank you very much, everyone out there. But I'm going to jump out just now. I have a lot of work to do, a lot of prep to make sure that Baz V Horror lands on Thursday, and at the same time get ready to drop number 8 in the top 10 countdown next week. And until then, please take care of yourselves out there, and I will speak to you sooner than you think. This is Duncan McLeish broadcasting live from the void, signing off.
Sunrise. This ain't no Hiroshima bomb.